What's up, everybody, and welcome to Mostly Film, your one-stop chaotic shop for all things in the world of cinema. I'm one of your hosts, Jonathan McWhorter, and my beautiful co-host, JP Payton.
Good evening, or good morning, or good afternoon, whichever.
Oof. That's supposed to be a camera click. It sounded like a whip. That's probably about right.
Sure. Why would you be making a camera sound right now?
Because it's 1 hour photo, baby.
Yeah.
Or because I'll either that or start doing like Leonard's Ticks, but I thought that'd be worse.
Yeah, that would be much worse.
Yeah, so I figured I would not do that. So even though we're talking about Awakenings first. I mean, yeah, first,
it would have been more acceptable.
Yeah. So we got two Robin Williams films once again for you this week. Yeah. 1990's Awakening, directed by Penny Marshall. And we also have 1 hour photo, 2002 psychological thriller film directed by Mark Romanek. So we'll start with Awakenings this week, which is directed by Penny Marshall, starring Robert De Niro and Robin Williams. Before I jump into it, have you heard anything about this movie prior?
I heard zero about this. In fact, if you had told me that there was a movie with Robin Williams and a young, you know, Robert De Niro, like both of them relatively young, I would have asked for, you know, where I could watch it as soon as possible, you know. No questions asked. I was very excited to know that this was one of the movies you were watching.
This is one of those films a couple of years ago when I decided I was going to watch through Robin Williams' filmography. I got through about 9 films. Yeah. I watched this one and I gave it 4.5 stars. Now I've lowered my rating to 4 stars after a rewatch. The shock and all what wore off after a second time. But still really enjoyed it. So I'll read the synopsis of the Letterboxd synopsis of Awakenings. There's no such thing as a simple miracle. Dr. Malcolm Sayer, a Shire research physician, uses an experimental drug to awaken the catatonic victims of a rare disease. Leonard is the first patient to receive the controversial treatment. His awakening, filled with awe and enthusiasm, proves a rebirth for Sayer, too, as the exuberant patient reveals life's simple but unutterably sweet pleasures to the introverted doctor. So this film stars Robin Williams as Dr. Malcolm Sayer and Robert De Niro as Leonard Rowe. Also has John Hurd supporting as a doctor, and Penelope Ann Miller playing Paula, one of the love interests. It also has a brief kind of cameo thing of Max von Sydow, who plays Peter. But I didn't realize Bradley Whitford's in this film. That's two Robin Williams films he's in. Plays Dr. Tyler, who is also the lawyer, Braddy's son from Bicentennial Man. So your first time watching. So Awakenings is shockingly based on a true story. Yes. I remember I called my dad the first time I watched this and I asked, do you remember that? And he's like, vaguely.
Yeah.
He said, it made a lot of the news back then. So it's wild. This whole thing, this had to have been like, I bet if this was a modern day thing, people would have been like, it's a miracle from the Lord.
Well, yeah. I think they chronologically twist, like change some stuff to this that makes it more exaggerated than what it is. But if this is 2024, like this is something we're tracking in our, you know, news feeds a lot. But yeah, since it's, is it the 60s, late 60s, I think 69, 68? Yeah,
this goes from like 67 to 72 is when the experiments ran. So somewhere in that time range.
Yeah.
Don't know exactly when, but somewhere in that time range.
So Do you want to hit? I'll hit the synopsis, see what we got in Letterboxd before.
I just read the synopsis in Letterboxd.
Oh, yeah, you did.
Yeah. So for me, my question is, so these based on true story, these guys are in a catatonic, like they're awake, but it's very like in a vegetative state almost. Very hard to communicate, very little, you know, just kind of
Hold on.
Catatonic is what.
Well, we're here because Dr. Sayer, who's played by
Robin Williams.
He's looking for a job. He has a degree. Like, I forget exactly what he's wanting to do. I think he's just wanting to study patients.
Yes.
But this clinic that he's come to interview for, they need doctors. Like, they need those that, like, people that will basically check a pulse, give a shot, like, the bare minimum. And that's kind of the vibe that you get. This is a hospital, whatever, that they call it the garden.
Yeah.
It's just basically a waiting room.
Not heal. Yeah.
Yeah.
But when you see the clientele, you understand they're not treating them bad. It's just.
But in reference to the garden, Robert Sayer is the type of person who wants to nurture, who wants to heal. He wants to diagnose and know what the root issues are, which therein causes a lot of interest in the actual patients that a lot of the other doctors simply do not have or a desire for.
Yeah, he's too, not restless. He's of science mind.
Yeah.
And he can't take the, hey, this is just their lot in life.
Yeah.
I'll let them be. So he's always researching, always paying attention to different kind of things, always bettering himself. And that's how he comes across this L-DOPA or whatever.
So what is it about these patients that kind of catches Sayre's attention then?
So Robert De Niro's character, Leonard, is one of his patients who's in a catatonic state and, you know, nonverbal, can't respond to, you know, catching a ball or anything like that. But he probably always finds out he can communicate with a Ouija board, not in like a demonic kind of way, just like moving it to the letter, how he's trying to communicate with him and highlighting it. So he's like, oh, hey, there's somebody in there. I'm going to kind of explore this and see how much or little I'm going to be able to talk to you at the end of the day. So this kind of sends him down this rabbit hole of researching and doing these different experiments with Leonard to see how he will respond to different things. And in this process, he comes across this drug called L-DOPA. He starts giving it to him a little bit, and little by little, he sees him coming out of this catatonic state to the point where he's functioning, walking, doing everything on his own, like a normal person pre-catatonic state. Leonard, Robert De Niro's character, becomes so normal that he's restless in the hospital and wants to be released, which Sayre won't do because he's running experiments on other people in the same catatonic states too that are after the success of him. But they still want to see long-term effects before they'll consider releasing it. And in this time, Robert De Niro's character develops feeling for Paula.
Yeah.
And she seems to be developing feelings for Leonard as well. Sayre, who is very depressing in this film, very downer.
Not downer. I just think he's a realist. He has very optimistic views on the possibilities of these people. But when it comes to himself and his own place in the world, he's very depressing, very glass half full. Something that you didn't hit on, which it's fine because I think it's overlooked, but I think it's an important like plot point, is that in figuring out the like what's that these people with these conditions that there is something there is, you know, it first starts with a patient who instinctively catches a ball and he kind of insinuates to the other doctors that, you know, there's something there because like there's will there, they're just borrowing the will from this ball. And you know, that's kind of like the running theme of this whole movie is, you know, a person's will.
Borrowed will, borrowed time. Will.
Yeah, borrowed time. Exactly. Which I think is really powerful. But yeah, he meets Paula, who I think is kind of the breaking point. This is Leonard's character. It's kind of like the breaking point. He develops these tics whenever he approaches the board, wanting to be free, wanting to walk about as he wishes.
Yeah.
And you know, we're led to believe that this is kind of L-DOPA's kind of limit. Like the drug is kind of, he's either experiencing setbacks with the drug, or his disease is more or less just getting worse. And it basically throws them into this point of just research. Like, okay, we're going to fully devote, as if it wasn't before, they were more focused on rehabilitating them, whereas now they're just, let's learn as much about this as we can.
Yep.
And how can we better ourselves? And basically, all these different people who had this condition just slowly kind of dwindled out back into their
And Leonard, cases. Since he did it first and had it the longest, all these other patients are going to see how they're going to revert.
He had the strongest dosage, too.
Yeah. So they realize, you know, they're studying it. Like I said, they're not going to keep recreating it because they understand, but it gives them all these people a second chance at life, briefly, to do whatever they need to do to come to terms with it. And Leonard, the worst, obviously, because, you know, he had it the longest, had freedom the longest, you know, goes to Penny, tells him that they have to end things. She does this dance with him, which was a great scene where she dances with him. And eventually he goes back to his catatonic state.
Yeah.
All of them do. And Sayre still stays and, you know, continues to communicate with him.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest thing, the biggest, like, emotional, because There's not really a win in this movie.
No.
So I think the thing that this movie wants to get out is, like you said, the idea of borrowed will. The thing that this story highlighted in that time was, A, to just because someone is not responsive doesn't mean that there's not hope there, that there's not someone behind the curtains, basically. Yep. And I think whenever she's circling the... I think she... I think it's just a story of humanity.
Yeah, it is. And out of all the films we've watched so far, this one has the strongest real world emotional effects.
Yeah.
Now, granted, it's based on a true story, but still, you get a lot of people. Like Rob De Niro was nominated for an Academy Award for this film.
Yeah, rightfully so. Yeah, I think
he was. He didn't win.
Do you know who he went up against?
You have to type in 1991 Oscars.
Yeah.
Win. I'm not sure.
I don't have the time.
he did win best actor in the New York Film Critics Circle.
Yeah.
He won a tie for best actor with Robin Williams in the National Board of Review Awards.
Yeah.
And Awakenings won top 10 films of the year for that year too. Randy Newman, who's famous for Toy Story, did the soundtrack for this film. He was nominated for a Grammy. Robin Williams was nominated for a Golden Globe, but De Niro wasn't, which is a surprise. Maybe I can click Best Picture for that year. Yeah, I'm going to find out.
Find out real time.
Yeah, real time, 91. There's the 1950s. Nope. No one cares about the 50s. Blow me, Dawson. whoa.
Yeah.
He went up. It's funny.
I have to say, 90s were a big, 1990, I think, was a big.
Jeremy Irons won.
In what?
Reversal of Fortune.
Okay.
He went up against Jeremy Irons, Kevin Costner, and Dance with the Wolves.
Yep.
Richard Harris in The Field.
Goodfellas as well.
Gerard DePardieu. And
but Dancing with Wolves was also the same year, you know, Goodfellas came out.
Now, 1991.
Yeah.
Like the next year. So that was the 91 Oscars. But the 1991 film, though, you had De Niro and Robin Williams going up against each other.
Wow.
For Fisher King and Cape Fear. But Anthony Hopkins won for Silence of the Lambs.
Anyway. I think it's amazing. And I mean, is there anything else about this?
No, not the film. The film itself, pretty straightforward. Depressed doctor comes in, science doctor.
Yeah.
Uses experimental drug, wakes these patients up, really miraculous, not like heavenly miraculous, but really miraculous.
No,
intervenes, get these people a second chance, gets to study, builds a great relationship. You see a lot of humanity. They go back to order. That's the film. And just the rest of it is filling in the humanity. The emotional, not like story points because it's real, but the emotional plot points, and you're there. The biggest thing about Awakenings for me is the performances. That's
Caitlin watched this one with me.
Oh, really?
I threw it on. And she asked me, "Is like what do you like? What's this movie about?" It's like I honestly have no idea. And she was the first one to like dig into is this movie like is this a true story type of thing? And she was honestly giving me real time like facts about it as we were watching. But the thing that like the moment that got her the most was whenever Leonard had first like woken up, and it's that morning.
Yeah.
And his mom comes to see him, and she that kind of got her. Obviously the pregnancy hormones were hyping strong. It up, but it was very, very touching. She looks at me and is like, "What if our daughter's not healthy?" I was like, "Please don't speak that evil."
Oh, here, gosh, Bobby. Dude, I know. I mean,
don't speak that evil.
It doesn't stop before birth. It continues.
I know.
If anything feels wrong at all their whole life, this is death.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
It was very emotionally effective.
Yeah.
I thought it was informative.
Did she like it?
Yeah. She liked it. It was honestly really informative.
It just makes me realize what a bubble I live in.
Yeah.
Now, granted, this was,
years.
Well before my time, but, when this actually happened, but it's still crazy to think about. Like, there's just so much we don't know, and there's like stuff like this that I'm sure is still happening. Well,
she's laying.
Oh, she looked like she was eating something over there.
I mean, when you think about it, the cause of this, which was, I forget the actual illness.
Effusigus ligaria or something like that.
It was 100 years ago.
Yeah.
So, I think it's I don't know, it's just crazy to see the cause and effect of, you know, you having this sickness that, you know, could have been a fever, and then, you know, years down the road, it leads to complete system failure. You know, it's just kind of crazy. What about this movie kind of stuck out to you the most?
De Niro's performance.
Yeah.
De Niro was great here, understandably nominated for an Oscar, but it isn't the speaking and the, what you would call, standard acting. Like when you think of an actor, like the way they talk, the way they expository.
This is presence.
Yeah. To me, it was like the beginning and the end. So like when he's coming out of it and when he's going back into it, those ticks and the facial expressions and the body mannerisms, like that is, the way he can control his facial stuff like that and consistently repeat it.
Yeah.
I'm sure
it's good acting.
So, so impressive. And, you know, we're in a day and age now where a lot of people take Robert De Niro for granted because he does movies like Dirty Grandpa and like,
Meet the Fockers
and all these other kind of films. Like you don't get to see a Robert De Niro of the past, like Taxi Driver and, this, and he's just an underappreciated gem, I think, in nowadays. And like this movie made me realize, like, even like his mobster stuff aside, like he can be a very tender, heartfelt actor too.
Yeah.
And also just strong.
Yeah. That was the thing that stuck out to me. You're at the height of kind of De Niro's kind of probably,
because 70s, 80s.
Edginess.
Yeah, that's King of De Niro. Was like he owned the 70s and the 80s.
And so to get this performance, I think, again, adds depth and layer to who we see De Niro as an actor.
Yeah.
On the same side, this was the most reserved yet effective Williams performance,
I agree. I was going to say, a lot of people say this is this is one of his worst performances.
No, I think it was extremely effective.
I agree. In the same way, he has more screen time than Dead Poets Society, but it's very similar to Dead Poets Society to me. He's not
the Dead Poets Society, he was still like whimsical. This performance was innocent yet
like Good Will Hunting.
Extremely. No, not even that, because again, there's this sense of like creativity to Williams.
And, yeah, true.
And I think this character was the most straight-laced, analytical, but yet extremely like innocent.
Yeah.
And you know, I think it was really effective because Williams's character is like I said, he's really innocent. He's obviously a shut-in, wallflower type character, and just kind of keeps himself. And whether that makes him a little stunted as far as maturity wise, but to have Leonard, who basically went comatose at the age of 20, come out, lose 30 years of his life, you have these two characters that I feel like are immediately able to relate. And I think it's really well done as far as how it's set up. Sayers, like, you see the connection there immediately for him and why he's so invested, because he sees, I think, himself in him. And I thought the whole relationship was great.
It was. They had great on-screen chemistry, very different for Williams, very understated performance, but emotionally resonant. So I really like this Williams performance too. He's not the main star. I would say he's like 60-40.
Williams?
60% De Niro, 40% Williams.
I think at the end of the day, I think Robert Williams is the star of this movie.
Well, if it's not for him, the film doesn't happen.
Yeah, probably 60-40, yes.
I'm just talking like screen time wise. Without Williams, similar to Dead Poets in this society, in this arrangement, Robin Williams may not be the present in the whole film of Dead Poets Society, but the whole film centers around Jack Keaton's character.
Yeah.
So it's a similar vibe to this. Even though he's not in it, it's still, his hand is still very prevalent. But yeah, no, Awakenings is great. Great, great, great performance, great outing by De Niro, great performance, great outing by Williams. Overall, just a really, really well-made film, well-scripted film, well-acted film, well-shot film, just a really, really solid outing. Plus, you get Vin Diesel in this film, as a hospital orderly, very young Vin Diesel that a lot of people missed. He's in it.
Yeah, I missed it completely.
And it's like the only film in the history of the planet where you can get Peter Stormare and it not be a crazy, crazy off the rails film. This guy.
Yeah.
He's a hospital orderly or neuroscientist. He's in it and, you know, the wheels don't fall off the film. Normally when he's in it, chaos ensues. So, yo, Awakenings is a really, really solid film. It's got a 3.9 on Letterboxd. I'm at 4 stars. I did lower to 0.5 star. First time I watched it, I was like just emotionally crushed and just involved. Second time, knowing what was coming, I was able to take the emotions out of it and just watch it from a pure cinema lover perspective. And
I gave it 3.5. I kind of went back and forth wanting to give it a 3 because I kind of felt like the ending, you know,
it's
like based off a true story, like the essence of that. So like, I know you're not going to have the ending that you want. So I kind of just let that be what it was and didn't let it affect my score.
Yeah.
So,
well, the performances alone for me warrant a 3 star. I feel like.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a solid film. You have any more closing thoughts on, Awakenings?
No. Well, tell me. Any facts?
No, the Vin Diesel, Peter Stormare, the Academy Award nominated things. And then apparently you told me he was
Cat. Yeah. So, yeah, that was one of the things that Caitlin pointed out. And it's funny because it's towards the end of the movie. She had said, you know, that the Dr. Sayre in real life is gay. And it's just kind of weird.
Probably dead now.
Well, yeah, probably. But it's just kind of weird how this movie ends. He's kind of pursuing a relationship with Marge Simpson, Julie Kavner's character, you know, and it's not outright like professing his love for her, but just that, just reaching out for that human connection. It's just interesting that a character like that in the 90s would be casted and portrayed in a way that's like, oh, he's just kind of socially awkward.
Yeah.
When in reality, he was just gay. and so. In hindsight, it's just kind of funny. But yeah, I enjoyed the movie.
Maybe that's what's wrong with Garrett.
You can't say that. On to our next movie.
Hey, what's the timestamp? I want to send this to him later.
22 minutes in.
No, I will say we've done really good with Robin Williams interview. Yeah. It's been about 20 to 30 minutes
each movie.
Film.
Yeah.
That's perfect. We've really honed it in.
Listen, 45 minutes is the sweet spot for a podcast.
Well, especially for in review.
Yeah.
So when you're doing two. And we've almost, just a second to brag, even on our first episode, the Tuesdays episodes, we've narrowed in down to about 1 hour 15 a piece compared to what we used to be at like 2 hours.
We had 2 or 3 weeks where there was like 1 hour, 1 hour 5.
Yeah.
And that was like,
yeah,
like God level.
Now, if this would have been a year ago and I watched 15 movies, we couldn't have done a trailer. We couldn't have done any news.
No, I don't even want to think about it.
It would have been 1 hour and 45 minutes of me reminiscing on the films.
I'm exhausted just thinking about it.
It would have been awesome.
Yeah.
Because I did do that when I watched Altered States and that blowout.
Listen, this just establishes, though, for our in review, we are never doing more than 2 movies a week.
No, unless there's just something that comes up.
No, there
could be a scenario.
No.
If we did a director who only had 3 films, I would watch his 3 films in a week.
And a one-off, a one-shot.
That's what I'm saying.
Yes.
I'm
saying like a series.
No, but we did like a director in review and it was like a Jonathan Glazer and he had 3.
And we just did 3 movies.
Yeah,
of
3 or 4 films. Yeah. I could do that in a week and just do a longer episode.
Okay.
But yeah, okay.
We should talk about our next movie then.
Sneaky Good.
Really?
I really enjoyed this film.
Okay, let's talk about it then.
1 Hour Photo. Robin Williams kind of break into the psychological thriller world. It's directed by Mark Romanek, who has also directed a bunch of stuff. I don't know. Never Let Me Go. Maybe I've heard of that one. Starring Carey Mulligan, Keira Knightley, and Andrew Garfield. Don't know if I know that one actually or not. So I don't really know a lot of his stuff. But here's the synopsis. The things that we fear the most have already happened to us. Cy, the photo guy, Parrish, has lovingly developed photos for the Yorkin family since their son was a baby. But as the Yorkins' lives become fuller, Cy's only seems lonelier until he eventually believes he's part of their family. When Uncle Cy's picture-perfect fantasy collides with an ugly dose of reality, what happens next has the spine-tingling elements of the best psychological thrillers. It's got 3.5 on Letterboxd. That's exactly where I landed. It's 3.5. I am a 3.5 with a lean to 3. Not a 3.5 with a lean to 4.
I'm a 3. I don't.
We're not far off.
Yeah, but I could not see this going to 3.5 for me.
Yeah, I couldn't see this going to 4 for me.
Yeah.
Now there was a part in this movie. I was like, "This is gonna be a 4-star film for me."
Yeah.
Not that I didn't like it. I just like, that's a 3.5.
It's not even the ending. I feel like whenever Sai is basically your now typical, because I feel like this character type was probably pretty fresh. Mm-hmm. Like you hadn't really scratched the surface on a lot of these. Yeah, because
this came out in 2002. So.
Yes. And it kind of feeds on probably a lot of paranoias in that time of, you know, child predators, like stalkers, like that is the vibe you get from
in the late 90s and early 2000s, or the 2000s, you're coming off the end of the serial killer runs of the late 80s and 90s. So,
yeah, and there's so many different points in this movie where our experience with movies like this now kind of lead us to assume and think something terrible is going to happen because people have done it.
That's part of the reason this film got a higher. That pump comes out of the 3-star range.
Yeah, because you see the blueprint.
Yeah, and it doesn't.
You appreciate it.
It doesn't try to shock you in any way. This is actually, a lot of people may think this feels safe, but this just feels probably more realistic than I think some people think.
We should talk about the movie then.
Yep.
Sai basically works at this one stop.
He works at Walmart.
Works at Walmart. Mart. For
which, what a great casting of Gary Cole as the manager.
Yes.
Office space.
Yeah. Dude, exactly what I thought.
I was like, what? This is great.
I mean, it's Robert De Niro snapping the finger the whole time he's on screen.
Clark Gregg from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. as the detective.
I missed that the first time he came on the screen. It wasn't until
the in-house interview.
Yeah. It wasn't until later. I was like, oh, crap.
And then your Justified guy, Nick Searcy, the photo tech guy who was Raylan's boss, Justified. I was like, what is this? This
crazy.
Is great.
I mean, he works at this photo booth and has fixated on this one family.
Because he develops films for everybody who comes in. So he gets to spend a lot of time with the pictures, getting to know the pictures, printing the pictures, knowing the family. Like you would in any time. Like when I worked at Walgreens, we developed, not like this kind of film, people bring us their...
Yeah.
You know, phones USB or whatever, and send them in, and you'd have your regulars, and I feel like I would know some of the people. Now, we didn't go through every photo, but you start recognizing people, so when people come pick up, you know, it is what
and,
it is.
And the thing is, though, at this time, this whole process, it was much more, artisan's not the right word.
You actually had rolls of film.
It's more personable, which causes Sai to fixate and become attached, because this family obviously took a lot of pictures, and so anyways...
And they also feel a little bit of an attachment to you because they know you're spending. It's not just like you got.
That's the thing, though. They didn't. I think she did. No, she didn't.
Not to the level that he did, but I feel like she felt a familiarity with the guy.
It's the same way that we do to like our barista, like when we go to get coffee or anywhere that you frequent, like in a customer-based relationship.
I've become friends with people like that before, though.
Well, you are an anomaly in that sense. Like,
see, maybe that's why I can relate.
For me,
yeah,
I am the wife, like in this point in the relationship where, like,
that's right,
you are. I'm like from arm's length, like I'm close to you. But the moment you get past that counter, it's like New Girl. Whenever
arm's length,
have you watched New Girl?
I've seen New Girl all the way through.
I can't remember if you're one of those people that hadn't.
Because Abby says I'm like a perfect Nick Miller and Schmidt. I say because
Nick's, you don't cross the bar rule.
Yeah,
like side cross the bar, whatever. Yeah. So, anyways.
Yeah. Hey, Arm's Length, by the way.
Yeah.
They released one of the greatest albums of all time.
Okay.
Ever. It's their first album, the one with Tough Love.
Yeah.
And everything as I knew it. I plug it shamelessly, Arm's Length.
So there's not a whole lot to talk about this movie because it's very,
very one dimensional.
It's very cut dry. Mm-hmm. Sai has fixated on this family for what reason? We don't know really. It doesn't allude to it.
I mean, it alludes to it.
How?
For sure. He is lonely.
Yeah.
I think she is nice to him, nicer than others. Not like a flirty way at all, but just nicer to him.
But
so
I never got the vibe that he loved her.
He loved her
in a platonic
way. Not, it was never like, I want to have sex with you and like have your babies. It was like, He wanted to be Uncle Si. He wanted to belong. And out of all the people that come into him, he felt the most. Maybe it's because they're the most.
It's because of the pictures. It's because of the pictures, because he's seeing the family life, the family that he wanted and desired.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his vision.
Because you find out he was sexually abused as a kid. So he never had that family. He never had that, you know, sense of belonging. Yeah. And he fills it with these people.
Yeah.
So, you know, I get it. I thought it diluted enough for me to that point. And the only standing is, and he tried to talk to the husband once and didn't go anywhere in the hall, or no, in the mall or the Walmart kind of place. And, you know, that was the final straw for him. And then especially when he saw the pictures of the affair, that was done. He was gonna, you know, he thought the wife and the son deserved more. So, well, I mean, I don't want to get ahead of myself, because he got fired before that too. So, anyway, so, you know, as the film is building, you know, they keep bringing him photos. He gives the son like a camera for his birthday, because he loves the family, like in a platonic, like uncle, you know, uncle's going to give you a free birthday. So he gives him a free camera. Mm-hmm. He offers to buy him toys. He goes and sees him at a soccer practice. He drives by their house when they're not there, and has this full fantasy where I thought he actually broke into the house and went in for a minute.
Yeah,
when I saw him pooping in their house, I was like, that's a psychopath.
I laughed out loud for that.
Yeah, I chuckled, and I was like, that's how you know somebody's a psychopath.
Yep.
And then honestly, I was a little taken back. I thought I really misread the film, though, when they came in the house and he didn't panic, and they opened the door like, oh, hey, Uncle Si. I was like,
Whoa, what's happening?
I did not, that this didn't feel like the film that would have that kind of fake out.
Yeah.
And I was like, what have I missed here? Actually, in my head, I watched it late at night. I thought I dozed off. And I was like, I thought they were going like, maybe he's a mental patient, like has dementia or something and he forgets. Yeah. But I don't know. Anyway, so he's obviously obsessive over this family. In his wall, in his apartment, he has just hundreds and hundreds of pictures of their family as wallpaper, basically, in his house. And there's a woman who brings these pictures in, and he finds out that the girl's pictures, she's like, I've seen you somewhere before. And it's because she's having an affair with the husband of the family he loves. So in this whole time, his boss doesn't really like him. And he finds out that the click count is off, which if you don't work in retail, the click count is very important. I had to fire people over the click count.
Yeah.
Click count's very important. That's how you know if you're stealing photos.
Mm-hmm.
And tell you what, even though they're like 25 cents a photo, a lot of people steal photos.
Mm.
So, or print them out for their families or whatever, which I tried to show grace where I could, but some people do steal a lot of photos. Anyway, so he gets fired. He doesn't handle it very well, goes and takes pictures of his boss's kid while she's out playing in his yard. So the police get involved, and that's how they kind of get on his trail to begin with. And as they're investigating him, they start looking at some of his other stuff, and they go to his house, and they find that he has these pictures of this family. So they put an APB out on the guy, and they go find him, or go talk to the family, and they can't find the husband because the husband's having an affair with this other customer at a hotel. Which Robin Williams is there checking in, and he goes in there and basically terroristic threatens these people. Doesn't actually kill them, which you're unsure about for a minute. Makes them do all these like sexual poses and stuff like together, but they're obviously terrified. Finally gets arrested there. No way out. Lets them live though. Traumatizes them. Lets them live. When the police arrest him, they're putting him in question. All he wants to do is see the pictures that he took. I want to see the pictures they took. When he gets the pictures, after he basically confides in the detective that he was sexually abused and all this other stuff growing up as a kid, he has a little pity on the guy.
Because,
you know, he didn't actually do anything that would warrant like life in prison or anything like that. So, you know, he's not going to go to, you know,
maybe
get Googled terroristic threatening and like stalking.
Yeah.
Back then, he probably would have got like 5 years or so.
Yeah.
Maybe, especially if he had a clean record prior to that.
I mean,
no,
you're gonna get a restraining order.
Yeah, restraining order, and maybe 5 years in prison for the assault kind of thing, right? Other than that, the detective kind of took pity on him, I think, is what happened. He lets him see the pictures, and it's pictures of
the bathroom,
the chair, nothing. So
no evidence.
There's no evidence that he did anything at all. So they can't tie him to anything.
Yeah.
And then the movie ends.
Yeah.
Did he take the pictures?
I don't think he did. I think, and this is something that I kind of, it kind of sat with me till after the movie. Yeah. It didn't kind of come up till after. We kind of had said, like, none of this we thought was sexual.
Yeah.
Obviously, because he was so sexually damaged as a child, which I think I kind of glossed over in the moment. It's just weird conceptually. It's weird how he basically did this to scare the husband straight.
Yeah.
And to basically fix the family.
Yeah. Which, because this show does do a good job of making you think it's going to be one way. And then, and it's not like you're going to whiplash. It's just like, oh, it's going to be, it's kind of like a roller coaster. You're going up the hill. You think it's going to be this, and you're going down, and you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like the creepiest moment for me, and the biggest, like, you moment for me, was freaking the soccer practice scene.
Yep.
That was like the get back, run away. Like, I want to look away type of moment. Mm-hmm.
Especially if they would have had that sexual child abuse moment earlier.
Yeah. In the movie, you would have been like, past.
Whoa.
Yeah. No, I'm glad they didn't. Because I think that was effective. And
yeah, I agree.
It left mystery there.
It did. And it also shows where the detective has sympathy on him. Because I'm sure at this point, they've interviewed the kid. They told him that he showed up at a soccer game and nothing happened. And they realize that this guy's just a damaged, innocent. I mean, innocent, maybe not the right word. But not even harmless. But you know what I'm trying to say.
No, he's
not a direct threat to these people outside of a stalking.
Yeah.
Now, granted, as a dad and a daughter, I'd be ready to shoot this dude in the face.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But it's kind of a catch-22 there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's, it was a good movie. It was kind of slow.
It was. It was a lot slower than I thought it was going to be.
Dramatically, like, the ups and downs were few and far between.
This movie was pretty constant for me all the way through.
Yeah, I mean, there's points of this that it felt very Jeffrey Dahmer like. It's like whenever we get to his house,
you know, it's the same person.
Yeah,
I didn't. The overseer and
yeah.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Yeah, it's gonna be a weird moment. Anyways, I that's what I was. Okay. Anyways, sorry. Just had to.
I was checking for Kentucky news.
Yeah,
I stay there.
What was I talking about though? Not that many dramatic moments. Felt like Jeffrey Dahmer. Whenever you're in his room, it's like super tight. Like there's just he's vanilla. Except whenever you see his collage wall of all the family photos.
Yeah, and then the X's all over the husband's face.
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah, I don't have any fun facts about this one, but I really enjoyed it. It's definitely different than any of the Robin Williams films we've seen so far, I think.
Yeah.
I actually can't really pick one that is similar. This one's kind of in a league of its own a little bit. Unless you have one. I can't. I'm looking around. I don't really see one.
Say it again.
Is there a Robin Williams film we've seen so far that is close to his performance here? I mean, you could say Insomnia, but I don't feel like we get enough of him in Insomnia to say it's a similar role.
Shoot, where are my tags? I was thinking about that earlier. And for me, the dynamic of the role felt very similar to Bicentennial Man.
Okay.
How as so? Far as very even keel, like dramatic beats weren't kind of didn't really fluctuate. It was just kind of always the same. I think that's it. It's definitely, I think, very precise. I think a lot of other Robin Williams roles, he kind of has his moves.
Yeah.
That he kind of always hits in these movies. And this one felt, I mean, starting off, like, the blonde hair.
That was a surprise.
That was the most unsettling
part. I didn't love that. I mean, I loved it for the...
It's effective.
I didn't love it otherwise.
And so, yeah, I think he... It's not his best role.
No, for sure.
It's definitely his most diverse role so far that we've watched, I feel like.
Yeah, looking at all the films, I was trying to look back because I know we always kind of rate how this one stands up compared to the other ones we've watched. It's unique. It's definitely its own role. Looking at all these other ones that, you know, that I just can't see one that was close enough for some of his other films are not interchangeable, but, you know, similar characters. If I was comparing him to another of the films that we've watched of his, I would probably say, and you're probably going to disagree here, World's Greatest Dad.
I could see that. Because World's Greatest Dad, I think, has you feeling there's only one way this movie could end.
Yeah.
And it ends totally different.
Mm-hmm.
This is very similar. I think the stakes are different and more thrilling, obviously. But the fact that you end 1 hour photo and you walk away thinking, wow, Cy wasn't that bad of a guy.
Yeah.
You know?
I know. Yeah. Mission accomplished.
That's like the weirdest plot twist I think that you have. And if I'm wrong, I don't know, maybe he is a sicko. Maybe he's a perv.
Yeah.
But how I interpret this movie is that he was just
people
like,
people listen to this right now. I'm like, these guys are sympathizers.
Probably.
We gotta quit listening.
Lock them up. I think that's probably a good take. I mean, Insomnia is the obvious, like, because it's similar story. What if different world? What if Cy moves to Alaska? And becomes a writer.
Yeah, there you go. That's where, because he gets off, deserves a few years, and then moves out there. Gets rehabilitated, doesn't actually die, fakes his death, and then goes and has a family, starts a kid, and you have World's Greatest Dad. Now you got full circle.
Yeah. There's totally a different world, though, where Cy and Sayer are like just cousins.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Definite loners that have no relation, you know, with their families, really. I could see it.
Yeah, I'm there too. So, tell me.
Yeah.
Where do these two rank in your Robin Williams mega list?
I mean, my mega list. I mean, when I pull up my highest rated, it has the Birdcage at the highest, which isn't the case. But I mean, it's a 3.5. So it is probably right now. Probably going to be What Dreams May Come, Good Morning Vietnam, World's Greatest Dad, The Birdcage, Awakening, who are all 3.5s. Then I've got probably Hook, Moscow on the Hudson, Insomnia, 1 Hour Photo, and then Bicentennial Man.
I'm excited for this week. They're two first-time watches for me. Every week so far, I've at least seen one of the two. Mm-hmm. Except for the first week with Birdcage and Moscow on the Hudson.
Yeah.
So this next week, we have The World According to Garp, 1982 film.
Yeah.
Directed by George Roy Hill, who did a bunch of classic films like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, The Sting, Slapshot, Funny Farm, Slaughterhouse-Five. I'm talking like those are all hugely famous, reputable films.
Uh-huh.
This film's got a 3.5 on Letterboxd. Stars Robin Williams, Mary Beth Hurt, Glenn Close, John Lithgow. I'm really interested to see this one. I've heard some very wild takes on this.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the ones we have next week. And then the other one is a 2006 directed film called The Night Listener, starring Robin Williams, Toni Collette, and Rory Culkin, and Sandra Oh, and Bobby Cannavale, baby. Once again, a very interesting and diverse cast.
What's the name of the movie?
The Night Listener. It's a thriller.
The Nightless?
Listener.
Night Listener.
Okay. It's got a 2.9 on Letterboxd, but all the reviews I see on mine are saying that's low. Don't understand why it's so low. So I'm interested to see that one as well. So those will be the two that we discuss next week. So a couple new ones for me. We're getting near the end. We have 1, 2, 3 more weeks after this.
This is another thriller. Like you said, it's rated low, but you know, you feel like a lot of people say it should be higher. Why is it that Robin Williams can't nail this thriller? Maybe we can talk about this in the next week, but it's a trend.
Yeah, because I'm looking at the rest of the films we have. Toys and Death to Smoochie, neither one of those are thrillers.
Yeah.
Jack and Cadillac, man, neither one of those are thrillers. Good Will Hunting and Mrs. Doubtfire, neither one of those are thrillers.
Yeah.
And then we also know Dead Poets Society, not a thriller. Then the rest of the films that are out there that he's in are mostly all comedies. So as far as I know, Insomnia, Night Listener, and
One Hour Photo
are his big three in terms of like a dramatic thriller kind of vibe. So I'm not sure. Yeah, we'll discuss that next week after we've watched all three of them. Kind of see, did he nail it? Did he not nail it? What could he do? What could he have done different? Blah blah blah.
Yeah.
So we'll see from there. Death to Smoochie arguably has some thrilling elements to it, but more of a comedic thriller.
Yeah, it's not
kind of like Willy's Wonderland kind of thing. So, I really enjoyed this Robin Williams interview. And I don't have that funk yet. And I think part of it is because he's very, we mentioned it earlier, he's so diverse in how, like, all of these films are wildly different. And his performances, while some of them are similar, they're all also unique and different to the film. So
I mean, because he's a unique person.
He really, really is. And a lot of people, I think one of the unspoken things about Robin Williams for me is just, you can tell he loves to act.
Yeah.
And like, he has a great time doing it and really pours his heart into it. That's the other one.
The final cut. Yeah.
But I didn't put that on there. It didn't make the final cut for me. So, I'm excited for another week of Robin Williams. I am not going to watch that many movies this next week. My hope is, though, we will have watched Challengers before this next week. That's the big one I want to watch between now and then. So, other than that, you have any closing thoughts?
I do not. It's always a pleasure and an honor.
Me neither.
Something I was thinking about, I was going to ask you real quick, check in, since we're on Letterboxd pretty actively, and you just logged a crap ton of movies this past week.
Yep.
What's your year-to-date
I finally movie? Caught you. 80.
Oh, really? I had watched more movies than you?
You had up until this week.
Wow.
You were at like 70.
Yeah, I've got 79.
Yeah.
Wow.
I did some work this week to chip away at it.
I would have never thought that I'd watch more movies than you so far.
I went on like a 3-week bender where I didn't watch anything but play games. There were like 3 weeks in a row you had films I didn't.
Yeah.
How many films have you watched for 2024? That's what I'm curious.
I've watched so far 10 films.
You've only seen 2024 releases?
Yes. Yeah.
Dang.
I think so. I might be missing some.
I've seen 32 now.
I mean, am I missing one that you know?
Dune 2, Snack Shack, Hundreds of Beavers.
Oh, yeah, I don't have Dune 2 on here.
Hundreds of Beavers, Riddle of Fire.
Hundreds of Beavers is a 2023.
I count them as 2024, same way as Dawson. If they weren't available to watch in America until 2024.
Oh, I thought I had checked that it was released.
A lot of these films say 2023 because they had some sort of like,
yeah, writer strike, all the other stuff.
And I don't count if they released it like TIFF or if I had no access to watch this movie in 2023, and they release it nationally, I count it 24. So Dune, Snack Shack, Hunter the Beavers, Riddle of Fire.
How did I forget Dune?
Late Night with the Devil, Civil War, Leroy, Texas. I'm just naming ones I know you watched too.
Mm-hmm.
Land of Bad, Dog Man.
Listen.
Roadhouse.
I stand by it.
Argyle.
You still need to watch Marmalade.
I'm going to. It's on my list.
I'm saying you need to watch it soon.
Maybe I'll get to it this week.
It is really good. Do that.
I am looking at my ratings, though. Dune 2 is still number one. I have the weirdest top four. My top four is bizarre.
Top four for the year?
2024 releases. Yeah. Dune 2, number one.
Yeah.
Snack Shack, Hundreds of Beavers, and Riddle of Fire. And then Late Night with the Devil and Seating round out. The Seating rounded out. I never would have thought Civil War would be outside of my top six. But it is. And I never would have thought Land of Bad would be in my top 10, but it still is.
Yeah.
What a great film. B1, yeah, that's... you still need to watch The Seating.
If you
can handle Late Night with the Devil, yeah, you can definitely do The Seating. So, and Leroy, Texas is right next to Civil War. I like that one too. But anyway, that's been another episode of Mostly Film, your one-stop chaotic shop for all things in the world of cinema. I've been one of your hosts, Jonathan McWhorter, joined by beautiful co-host, JP Payton.
See you guys later.
See y'all later. Bye.